I would like to welcome Simon Mabon to the workshop.
Thank you so much.
And give you 20 minutes to enlighten us.
Thank you. Thank you, Rehan, for the invitation and for all of your efforts. Thank you, Eugene, for your kind words, kind invitation, hosting. And I will do my best to follow what was an excellent presentation. And I think it sets up what I was going to talk about quite nicely. So thank you for the foresight and the careful planning. My talk is about Saudi and Iran and how the Saudi-Iran dynamics have shifted, or indeed not shifted, post-October 7. And I thought I'd start with a quote from Fred Halliday, the late great Fred Halliday, who remarked that it's very easy to say that everything has changed. It's very easy to say that nothing has changed. And the reality is probably somewhere in the middle. And I think that's kind of appropriate for what I'm going to be talking about today. With regard to the Saudi-Iran rivalry, rapprochement, relationship, pragmatic dynamics, depending how you want to frame it. It's something that I've been working on for a couple of decades now. And over that period of time, it's oscillated between moments of overt hostility, strange incidents of, let me get this right, Mexican drug cartels being hired by the cousin of an Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps member to assassinate Adel Al-Jubeir in 2011. It's a very strange story that sort of disappeared quite quickly, but you'll find it online, and that was 2 days before I was due to submit my PhD on Saudi-Iran relations. So I was pulling what little hair I had left out of my head, very, very worried. But some 13 years later, we're in a very different position. And I think we're in a different position in light of some pretty dramatic shifts in transnational relations, some pretty dramatic shifts in the way in which regional politics is being constructed, the role of the United States, for example, the shifting contours of Israeli-Arab relations, and a broader pragmatism that I think has started to emerge in Saudi strategic thinking, perhaps in some elements of Iranian strategic thinking, and across the region more broadly. So what I'm going to try and do is trace the evolution of that and position what happened with October 7 in that broader sort of long-ish durée, or shortish durée, I guess, of Saudi-Iranian relations. And I think there's three main ways of understanding Saudi-Iran relations. One is to reduce it purely to power politics and say religion is being used instrumentally. It's all about power, it's all about national interest. That is obviously problematic for a number of reasons. Another is to say it's all about religion, it's all about Sunni versus Shia, which is probably more problematic than the first one, for obvious reasons. And then the third approach is more sort of nuanced, to say, well, actually religion and power and national interest and ethnicity all sort of come together at particular moments in time and are mobilized or deployed by those in positions of power in pursuit of their interests, in pursuit of the collective goal, and shaped by the contingencies and complexities of time and space. And what my most recent book tried to do was show that this rivalry between the Saudis and the Iranians wasn't just monolithic. It didn't just play out in a hegemonic, singular way across the region, but actually was quite malleable and conditioned by what was happening across what I identified as five different arenas of competition and contestation. So I focused on Bahrain, Iraq, Lebanon, it's outside.
So yeah. You go ahead.
Syria and Yemen. And the political, economic, social, religious, structural, geopolitical context of those different arenas created different types of transnational relationships, some of which were predicated on sect-based affinity. Some were predicated on ideological affinity. Some were predicated purely on who can help us to counter the threat posed by our rival in that particular context. And what I tried to do in that book was trace how these things played out and ground it more sort of spatially and temporally. And I think that's, I would say this of course, but I think that's quite a useful way of looking at where we are right now in terms of looking at the factors that are giving rise to the evolution of Saudi-Iranian relations. So if I talk a little bit about the historical context and then segue into the more recent past. If we look at the history of relations or rivalry between the two, you can see from sort of a century ago, and I imagine you're far more qualified than I to talk about this, you see some interesting dynamics at play with the Shah and Ibn Saud recognizing each other, acknowledging the right of Persia and Saudi Arabia to emerge as political projects in this post World War I world. You see the two broadly agreeing with one another on a number of issues. You see them collaborating. You see politics sort of trumping, I shouldn't really say that, should I now? Forgiven, I hope. Trumping religious difference. Neither wanted to privilege and prioritize religion over the national interest, although there were some tensions emerging from within Persia, later Iran, of course, over how Shia communities were being treated within Saudi Arabia and how pilgrims were being treated within the Hajj. So the reason for mentioning that is we go back a century and we get a very political type of rivalry that wasn't so much a rivalry, it was a relationship. It was collaboration, cooperation, a little bit of contestation, but politically driven, with the undertones of religious concern. Now, of course, 1979 changed everything, not just with the revolution, not just with the establishment of the Islamic Republic, but rather the fusion of politics and religion, the politicization of Islam, the seizure of the Grand Mosque, of course, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the increasing unrest that spilled out across the region, inspired by, influenced by, supported by Iran. And that adds a different flavor to the rivalry, adds a different type of transnational contestation. And you get this period where the two states and elites in both states are embroiled in this rhetorical cycle, tit for tat rhetoric, rejecting the legitimacy of the other. One is the standard Saudi line, which MBS used a decade ago, comparing the Iranian leadership to Nazis. The Iranians reject the legitimacy of the Al Saud, call them infidels. Unfit, unworthy to be the protectors of the two holy places, etc., etc. And this reverberates across the region, across the wider Muslim world, into the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, etc. So, with the sort of the injection of religion into these transnational dynamics, the nature of the rivalry becomes more fraught. There's an existential dimension here, in the sense that the Iranians wanted the Islamic legitimacy for their new political project, whereas the Saudis were reliant on legitimacy in terms of their own position within both the kingdom and the wider Islamic world. We then have, obviously, the war with Iraq and the death of Khomeini. So with the death of Khomeini, we start to see this burgeoning rapprochement, this opening up of relations. We see Crown Prince Abdullah, later King Abdullah, making a lot of diplomatic work, doing a lot of diplomatic legwork to try and open up relations with Iran. We see the Iranians reciprocating, and in part I think that reflects the political structures that were playing out in Iran. But we see this period of burgeoning rapprochement, where the two begin to work closer and closer together. There was a devastating earthquake in Iran, a Saudis sent condolences and a great deal of financial support. So there's this positive moment until 2003. And I guess I should mention just before there was, in the aftermath of 9/11, the Iranians were working closely with the Americans with regard to Afghanistan. So things start to shift, I guess, with the Axis of Evil speech, but they deteriorate dramatically with 2003, the US-led invasion of Iraq. And this opens up a broader geopolitical competition. It opens up the conditions to give rise to sectarian violence in Iraq and across the wider region. In Bahrain, for example, there were widespread demonstrations in support of Iraqi Shia. At this point in time, about 2007, the Bahraini king, King Hamad, who was facing his own serious domestic pressures, reached out to the Americans to say, I want to normalize with Israel because I'm worried about Iran. Mm-hmm. And so this is, 13 years before the Abraham Accords, he's saying, look, we need to normalize. We need to have Israel on side. So this is sort of Shia Crescent time. This is nefarious Iranian presence across the region, Iranian puppet master, all of these sort of securitizing moves culminating in what King Hamad said. We see the Arab uprisings, all of this happens. The opening up of sect-based cleavages in pursuit of geopolitical, political, economic interests. And it plays out across the different cases that I've mentioned. But what we start to see, I think, we see a lot of hostility when Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman comes to power. He's clearly, at this point, ideologically driven, bombastic, living up to the moniker of Abu Rasasa, the father of the bullet, trying to get things done in his way very, very quickly. And I think the case of Saad Hariri and his fateful trip to Riyadh highlights the lack of diplomatic subtlety, as does the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. But somewhere around this time, we start to see a shift in the thinking of the Saudis in terms of how they are approaching their influence across the region. And I'm thinking here in particular of Lebanon. And the Saudis have got this long-standing relationship with the Hariri family, of course. Both Rafik and Saad were Saudi allies, key partners in the Saudi effort to curtail the influence of Hezbollah and, by extension, Iran. But what we start to see, and this, I think, is where we see a pragmatic turn, is the Saudis realizing that Hariri wasn't able to provide them with what they were looking for in Lebanon, and they start looking elsewhere. They go away from the Sunni bloc, if you will, and they start looking at Christian groups. So they reach out to the Lebanese forces, they reach out to Samir Jaja, and they cultivate these relationships, transnational relationships, based on economic interests and political interests, not based on sectarian affinity, which had been the key sort of tool or the lever that they would pull whenever the situation arose. And I bring this up because I think it's actually quite important to note that we see, whether it's MBS maturing as a decision maker, or whether it's a pragmatic turn that's influenced by members of the royal court and key decision makers, I guess that's something that we're not going to find out, but we start to see this pragmatic shift, realization that there are other ways of doing politics. And the other point is that 2019, the Abqaiq attacks, the Houthi attacks on Saudi oil infrastructure, the Saudis, I think, were pretty frustrated that the Americans didn't jump in. They'd been saying for a decade, I guess, that something needed to be done about Iran. King Abdullah's famous remarks about cutting off the head of the snake, for example. But then when the Houthis struck the lifeblood of the Saudi economy and Washington did nothing, I think there was a real sense of, okay, we cannot keep doing things in the way that we're doing them, because we can't rely on the ski state that had been our security guarantor for 70 years?
Yeah.
My math is right.
Yeah.
So that, I think, is an existential moment in Saudi decision making that says, okay, we need to start doing things differently. They can't rely on the US. And that was under Trump. Biden comes in, he starts pushing the human rights agenda. He starts criticizing the Saudis for their approach to democracy and human rights. Again, this sort of doubles down their thinking that the way that they've been doing politics, the way that they've been trying to engage with the region, isn't going to keep working, at least not in the same way. So I think we start to see a shift, a pragmatic shift in the transnational workings of Saudi foreign policy at this point. So there's all these different initiatives that are going on. And eventually, cultural initiatives, political initiatives, environmental initiatives. There were lots of really interesting environmental work done by civil society organizations. A lot of European actors were doing this really valuable work. And it gets to a point where Beijing is able to get the deal over the line. Now, that surprised a lot of people, obviously, these two great rivals coming together with a shared vision of what the region ought to be moving forward. But it was a pragmatic vision, and I think pragmatism is the way of looking at this. It was a sense that Riyadh couldn't rely on Washington, mm-hmm. that Tehran was in dire need of a capital investment. It needed the money, it needed to reintegrate itself. And Riyadh, Abu Dhabi, Manama, all accepted that the way for a more stable region was to reintegrate Iran. Now, the X factor, of course, then, is Israel. And the moves towards normalization appeared to jeopardize that. So Israel is the spoiler. So I was in Geneva a few weeks ago, and I was at a tractor event between Saudis with Saudis and Iranians that was fascinating. And the consensus position was that normalization between the Saudis and Israelis was something that was for the future, maybe, if and only if certain steps were being taken, i.e. irreversible steps towards a Palestinian state. What was really interesting, though, is that was the consensus position. The Saudis and the Iranians were pretty much united in this. They were pretty much on the same page with almost everything that was talked about. And I think that's really quite, well, optimistic. I think a lot of people were expecting the Saudi-Iran deal to very, very quickly unravel. There wasn't much progress in Yemen. There hadn't been a lasting peace agreement in Yemen. There were the strikes in Syria, the strikes in Iraq, the strikes in Iran, the devastation of Gaza and South Lebanon. And yet the Saudi-Iran deal's holding. And I think that offers a sliver of hope that there is a pragmatic shift towards a region-first way of looking at security, at collaboration, at the future. I guess there's a lot of questions that need to be answered, particularly in terms of how is this actually going to manifest in societies such as Lebanon, Iraq, Yemen, Syria. There's a lot that still needs to be done, but we've seen Saudi and Iranian officials meeting pretty regularly, senior officials meeting pretty regularly, having very serious diplomatic talks, having security-based talks. I didn't think I'd end on a bit of a positive, but I think there is a sliver.
We do.
Well, this may be sleep deprivation here, but after witnessing what I've witnessed with this particular rivalry over the past few decades, like, I think this is a positive moment, and seeing Iranians and Saudis bowling together on mixed teams at the end of a serious couple of days of track two diplomacy, it was something. Okay, I think I'll leave it there. Thank
Fantastic.
You.
Thank you.